Welcome back, everyone, to 1001 Stories for the Road and Arthur Conan Doyle's The Hound of the Baskervilles. Today, Chapters 3 and 4. Chapter 3, The Problem. I confess, at these words, a shudder passed through me. There was a thrill in the doctor's voice which showed that he himself was deeply moved by that which he told us. Holmes leaned forward in his excitement, and his eyes had the hard, dry glitter which shot from them when he was keenly interested.
"You saw this? As clearly as I see you. And you said nothing. What was the use? How was it that no one else saw it? The marks were some 20 yards from the body, and no one gave them a thought. I don't suppose I should have done so had I not known this legend."
"Are there many sheepdogs on the moor?"
"No doubt, but this was no sheepdog."
"You say it was large?"
"Enormous."
"But it had not approached the body?"
"No."
"What sort of night was it?"
"Damp and raw."
"But not actually raining?"
"No."
"What is the alley like?"
"There are two lines of old yew hedge, 12 feet high and impenetrable. The walk in the center is about 8 feet across."
"Is there anything between the hedges and the walk?"
"Yes, there's a strip of grass about 6 feet wide on either side."
"I understand that the yew hedge is penetrated at one point by a gate?"
"Yes, the wicket gate which leads onto the moor."
"Is there any other opening?"
"None."
"So that to reach the yew alley, one either has to come down it from the house, or else to enter it by the moor gate?"
"There is an exit through a summer house at the far end."
"Had Sir Charles reached this?"
"No. He lay about 50 yards from it."
"Now tell me, Dr. Mortimer, and this is important, the marks which you saw were on the path and not on the grass?"
"No marks could show on the grass."
"Were they on the same side of the path as the moor gate?"
"Yes, they were on the edge of the path on the same side as the moor gate."
"You interest me exceedingly. Another point. Was the wicket gate closed?"
"Closed and padlocked."
"How high was it?"
"About 4 feet high."
"Then anyone could have got over it?"
"Yes."
"And what marks did you see by the wicket gate?"
"None in particular."
"Good heaven! Did no one examine?"
"Yes, I examined, myself."
"And found nothing?"
"It was all very confused. Sir Charles had evidently stood there for 5 or 10 minutes."
"How do you know that?"
"Because the ash had twice dropped from his cigar."
"Excellent. This is a colleague, Watson, after our own heart. But the marks?"
"He had left his own marks all over that small patch of gravel. I could discern no others."
Sherlock Holmes struck his hand against his knee with an impatient gesture. "If I had only been there," he cried, "it is evidently a case of extraordinary interest, and one which presented immense opportunities to the scientific expert. That gravel page, upon which I might have read so much, has been long ere smudged by the rain and defaced by the clogs of curious peasants. Oh, Dr. Mortimer, Dr. Mortimer, to think that you should not have called me in! You have indeed much to answer for."
"I could not call you in, Mr. Holmes, without disclosing these facts to the world, and I've already given my reasons for not wishing to do so. Besides,
"Why do you hesitate?"
"There is a realm in which the most acute and most experienced of detectives is helpless."
"You mean that the thing is supernatural?"
"I did not positively say so."
"No, but you evidently think it."
"Since the tragedy, Mr. Holmes, there have come to my ears several incidents which are hard to reconcile with the settled order of nature."
"For example?"
"I find that before the terrible event occurred, several people had seen a creature upon the moor which corresponds with this Baskerville demon, and which could not possibly be any animal known to science. They all agreed that it was a huge creature, luminous, ghastly, and spectral. I have cross-examined these men, one of them a hard-headed countryman, one a farrier, and one a moorland farmer, who all tell the same story of this dreadful apparition, exactly corresponding to the hellhound of the legend. I assure you that there is a reign of terror in the district, and that it is a hardy man who will cross the moor at night.
And you, a trained man of science, believe it to be supernatural?
I do not know what to believe.
Holmes shrugged his shoulders. I have hitherto confined my investigations to this world, said he. In a modest way, I have combated evil, but to take on the father of evil himself would, perhaps, be too ambitious a task. Yet you must admit that the footmark is material.
The original hound was material enough to tug a man's throat out, and yet he was diabolical as well.
I see that you have gone quite over to the supernaturalists. But now, Dr. Mortimer, tell me this. If you hold these views, why have you come to consult me at all? You tell me in the same breath that it is useless to investigate Sir Charles's death, and that you desire me to do it.
I did not say that I desired you to do it.
Then how can I assist you?
By advising me as to what I should do with Sir Henry Baskerville, who arrives at Waterloo Station.
And Dr. Mortimer then looked at his watch.
In exactly 1 hour and a quarter.
He being the heir?
Yes. On the death of Sir Charles, we inquired for this young gentleman and found that he had been farming in Canada. From the accounts which have reached us, he's an excellent fellow in every way. I speak now not as a medical man, but as a trustee and executor of Sir Charles's will.
There is no other claimant, I presume?
None. The only other kinsman whom we have been able to trace was Roger Baskerville, the youngest of 3 brothers, of whom poor Sir Charles was the elder. The second brother, who died young, is the father of this lad, Henry. The third, Roger, was the black sheep of the family. He came of the old, masterful Baskerville strain, and was the very image, they tell me, of the family picture of old Hugo.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
He made England too hot to hold him, fled to Central America, and died there in 1876 of yellow fever. Henry is the last of the Baskervilles. In 1 hour and 5 minutes, I meet him at Waterloo Station. I've had a wire that he arrived at Southampton this morning. Now, Mr. Holmes, what would you advise me to do with him?
Why should he not go to the home of his fathers?
It seems natural, does it not? And yet, consider that every Baskerville who goes there meets with an evil fate. I feel sure that if Sir Charles could have spoken with me before his death, he would have warned me against bringing this, the last of the old race and the heir to great wealth, to that deadly place. And yet it cannot be denied that the prosperity of the whole poor, bleak countryside depends upon his presence. All the good work which has been done by Sir Charles will crash to the ground if there is no tenant of the hall. I fear lest I should be swayed too much by my own obvious interest in the matter, and that is why I bring the case before you and ask for your advice.
Holmes considered for a little time. Put into plain words, the matter is this, said Holmes. In your opinion, there is a diabolical agency which makes Dartmoor an unsafe abode for a Baskerville. Is that your opinion?
At least I might go to the length of saying that there is some evidence that this may be so.
Exactly. But surely, if your supernatural theory be correct, it could work the young man evil in London as easily as it could in Devonshire. A devil with merely local powers like a parish vestry would be too inconceivable a thing.
You put the matter more flippantly, Mr. Holmes, than you probably would do if you were brought into personal contact with these things. Your advice, then, as I understand it, is that the young man will be as safe in Devonshire as in London. He comes in 50 minutes. What, would you recommend?
I recommend, sir, that you take a cab, call off your spaniel who is scratching at my front door, and proceed to Waterloo to meet Sir Henry Baskerville.
And then?
And then you will say nothing to him at all, until I have made up my mind about the matter.
How long will it take you to make up your mind?
Give me 24 hours. At 10 o'clock tomorrow, Dr. Mortimer, I will be much obliged to you if you will call upon me here, and it will be of help to me in my plans for the future, if you will bring Sir Henry Baskerville with you.
I will do so, Mr. Holmes.
He scribbled the appointment on his shirt cuff and hurried off in his strange, peering, absent-minded fashion. Holmes stopped him at the head of the stair.
Only one more question, Dr. Mortimer. You say that before Sir Charles Baskerville's death, several people saw this apparition upon the moor?
3 people did.
Did any see it after?
I have not heard of any.
Thank you. Good morning.
Holmes returned to his seat with that quiet look of inward satisfaction, which meant that he had had a congenial task before him.
Going out, Watson?
Unless I can help you, yes.
No, my dear fellow. It is at the hour of action that I turn to you for aid. But this is splendid, really unique from some points of view. When you pass Bradley's, would you ask him to send up a pound of the strongest shag tobacco?
Thank you.
It would be as well if you could make it convenient not to return before evening. Then I should be very glad to compare impressions as to this most interesting problem, which has been submitted to us this morning.
I knew that seclusion and solitude were very necessary for my friend in those hours of intense mental concentration, during which he weighed every particle of evidence, constructed alternative theories, balanced one against the other, and made up his mind as to which points were essential and which immaterial. I therefore spent the day at my club and did not return to Baker Street until evening. It was nearly 9 o'clock when I found myself in the sitting room once more. My first impression as I opened the door was that a fire had broken out, for the room was so filled with smoke that the light of the lamp upon the table was blurred by it. As I entered, however, my fears were set at rest, for it was the acrid fumes of strong, coarse tobacco which took me by the throat and set me coughing. Through the haze I had a vague vision of Holmes in his dressing gown coiled up in an armchair with his black clay pipe between his lips. Several rolls of paper lay around him.
"Caught cold, Watson," said he.
"Nah, it's this poisonous atmosphere."
"I suppose it is pretty thick, now that you mention it."
"Thick? It's intolerable."
"Open the window, then. You've been at your club all day, I perceive."
"My dear Holmes!"
"Am I right?"
"Certainly."
"But how did you know?"
He laughed at my bewildered expression.
"There's a delightful freshness about you, Watson, which makes it a pleasure to exercise any small powers which I possess at your expense. A gentleman goes forth on a showery and miry day, with the gloss still on his hat and his boots. He has been a fixture, therefore, all day. He's not a man with intimate friends. Where, then, could he have been? Is it not obvious?"
"Well, I guess it is rather obvious."
"The world is full of obvious things which nobody by any chance ever observes. Where do you think that I have been?"
"A fixture also."
"On the contrary, I've been to Devonshire."
"In spirit?"
"Exactly. My body has remained in this armchair, and has, I regret to observe, consumed in my absence 2 large pots of coffee, and an incredible amount of tobacco. After you left, I sent down to Stamford's for the ordnance map of this portion of the moor, and my spirit has hovered over it all day. I flatter myself that I can find my way about."
"A large-scale map, I presume?"
"Very large."
He unrolled one section and held it over his knee.
"Here you have the particular district which concerns us. That is Baskerville Hall in the middle."
"With woods around it?"
"Exactly. I fancy the yew alley, although not marked under that name, must stretch along this line, with the moor, as you perceive, upon the right of it. This small clump of buildings here is the hamlet of Grimpen, where our friend Dr. Mortimer has his headquarters. Within a radius of 5 miles, there are, as you see, only a very few scattered dwellings. Over here is Laughter Hall, which was mentioned in the narrative. There is a house indicated here which may be the residence of the naturalist. Stapleton, I think it was. Yeah, that's it. That was his name. Here are two moorland farmhouses, High Tor and Falmar. Then 14 miles away, the great convict prison of Princetown. Between and around these scattered points extends the desolate, lifeless moor. This, then, is the stage upon which tragedy has been played, and upon which we may help to play it again. It must be a wild place. Yes, the setting is a worthy one. If the devil did desire to have a hand in the affairs of men, then you are yourself inclining to the supernatural explanation. Well, the devil's agents may be of flesh and blood, may they not? There are two questions waiting for us at the outset. The one is whether any crime has been committed at all. The second is, what is the crime, and how was it committed? Of course, if Dr. Mortimer's surmise should be correct, and we are dealing with forces outside the ordinary laws of nature, there is an end of our investigation. But we are bound to exhaust all other hypotheses before falling back upon that one. I think we'll shut that window again, if you don't mind. It is a singular thing, but I find that a concentrated atmosphere helps a concentration of thought. I have not pushed it to the length of getting into a box to think, but that is the logical outcome of my convictions. Have you turned the case over in your mind? Yes, I've thought a good deal of it in the course of the day. Well, what do you make of it? It is very bewildering. It has certainly a character of its own. There are points of distinction about it. That change in the footprints, for example. What do you make of that? Mortimer said that the man had walked on tiptoe down that portion of the alley. He only repeated what some fool had said at the inquest. Why should a man walk on tiptoe down the alley? What then? He was running, Watson, running desperately, running for his life, running until he burst his heart and fell dead upon his face. Running from what? There lies our problem. There are indications that the man was crazed with fear before he ever began to run. How can you say that? I am presuming that the cause of his fears came to him across the moor. If that were so, and it seems most probable, only a man who had lost his wits would have run from the house instead of towards it. If the gypsy's evidence may be taken as true, he ran with cries for help in the direction where help was least likely to be. Then again, whom was he waiting for that night, and why was he waiting for him in the yew alley rather than in his own house? You think that he was waiting for someone? The man was elderly and infirm. We can understand his taking an evening stroll, but the ground was damp and the night inclement. Is it natural that he should stand for 5 or 10 minutes? As Dr. Mortimer, with more practical sense than I should have given him credit for, deduced from the cigar ash. But he went out every evening. I think it unlikely that he waited at the moor gate every evening. On the contrary, the evidence is that he avoided the moor. That night, he waited there. It was the night before he made his departure for London. The thing takes shape, Watson. It becomes coherent. Might I ask you to hand me my violin, and we will postpone all further thought upon this business until we've had the advantage of meeting Dr. Mortimer and Sir Henry Baskerville in the morning. Chapter 4. Sir Henry Baskerville. Our breakfast table was cleared early, and Holmes waited in his dressing gown for the promised interview. Our clients were punctual to their appointment, for the clock had just struck 10 when Dr. Mortimer was shown up, followed by the young baronet. The latter was a small, alert, dark-eyed man, about 30 years of age, very sturdily built, with thick black eyebrows and a strong, pugnacious face. He wore a ruddy-tinted tweed suit,
and had the weather-beaten appearance of one who has spent most of his time in the open air. And yet there was something in his steady eye and the quiet assurance of his bearing which indicated the gentleman.
"This is Sir Henry Baskerville,"
said Dr. Mortimer. "Why, yes," said he. "And the strange thing is, Mr. Sherlock Holmes, that if my friend here had not proposed coming round to you this morning, I should have come on my own account. I understand that you think out little puzzles, and I've had one this morning which wants more thinking out than I am able to give it."
"Pray take a seat, Sir Henry. Do I understand you to say that you have yourself some remarkable experience since you arrived in London?"
"Nothing of great importance, Mr. Holmes. Only a joke, as like as not. It was this letter, if you can call it a letter, which reached me this morning." He laid an envelope upon the table, and we all bent over it. It was of common quality, grayish in color. The address, Sir Henry Baskerville, Northumberland Hotel, was printed in rough characters. The postmark, Charing Cross, and the date of posting, the preceding evening.
"Who knew that you were going to the Northumberland Hotel?"
asked Holmes, glancing keenly across at our visitor.
"No one could have known. We only decided after I met Dr. Mortimer."
"But Dr. Mortimer was no doubt already stopping there."
"No, I'd been staying with a friend," said the doctor. "There was no possible indication that we intended to go to this hotel."
"Well, someone seems to be very deeply interested in your movements."
Out of the envelope, he took a half sheet of foolscap paper folded into four. This he opened and spread flat upon the table. Across the middle of it, a single sentence had been formed by the expedient of pasting printed words upon it. It ran, "As you value your life or your reason, keep away from the moor." The word "moor" only was printed in ink. "Now," said Sir Henry Baskerville, "perhaps you will tell me, Mr. Holmes, what in thunder is the meaning of that, and who is it that takes so much interest in my affairs?"
"What do you make of it, Dr. Mortimer? You must allow that there is nothing supernatural about this, at any rate."
"No, sir, but it might very well come from someone who is convinced that the business is supernatural."
"What business?" asked Sir Henry, sharply. "It seems to me that all you gentlemen know a great deal more than I do about my own affairs."
"You shall share our knowledge before you leave this room, Sir Henry. I promise you that," said Holmes. "We will confine ourselves for the present, with your permission, to this very interesting document, which must have been put together and posted yesterday evening. Have you yesterday's Times, Watson?"
"I've got it right over here in the corner."
"Might I trouble you for it? The inside page, please, with the leading articles."
He glanced swiftly over it, running his eyes up and down the columns.
"Capital article on this free trade. Permit me to give you an extract from it. You may be cajoled into imagining that your own special trade or your own industry will be encouraged by a protective tariff, but it stands to reason that such legislation must in the long run keep away wealth from the country, diminish the value of our imports, and lower the general conditions of life on this island." "What do you think of that, Watson?"
cried Holmes, in a high glee, rubbing his hands together with satisfaction.
"Don't you think that's an admirable sentiment?"
Dr. Mortimer looked at Holmes with an air of professional interest, and Sir Henry Baskerville turned a pair of puzzled dark eyes upon me. "I don't know much about the tariff and things of that kind," said he, "but it seems to me we've got a bit off the trail so far as that note is concerned."
"On the contrary, I think we're particularly hot upon the trail, Sir Henry. Watson here knows more about my methods than you do, but I fear that even he has not quite grasped the significance of this sentence."
"No, I confess I see no connection."
"And yet, my dear Watson, there is so very close a connection that the one is extracted out of the other. You, your life, reason, value, keep away from the... Don't you see now whence these words have been taken?"
"By thunder, you're right. Well, if that isn't smart,
cried Sir Henry.
"If any possible doubt remained, it is settled by the fact that keep away and from the are cut out in one piece."
"Well, now, so it is."
"Really, Mr. Holmes, this exceeds anything which I could have imagined,"
said Dr. Mortimer, gazing at my friend in amazement.
"I could understand anyone saying that the words were from a newspaper, but that you should name which, and add that it came from the leading article, is really one of the most remarkable things I've ever known. How did you do it?"
"I presume, Doctor, that you could tell the skull of a Negro from that of an Esquimaux."
"Most certainly."
"But how?"
"Well, because that's my special hobby. The differences are obvious. The supraorbital crest, the facial angle, the maxillary curve, the—"
"But this is my special hobby, and the differences are equally obvious. There is as much difference to my eyes between the leaded bourgeois type of a Times article and the slovenly print of an evening halfpenny paper as there could be between your Negro and your Esquimaux. The detection of types is one of the most elementary branches of knowledge to the special expert in crime, though I confess that once when I was very young, I confused the Leeds Mercury with the Western Morning News. But a Times leader is entirely distinctive, and these words could have been taken from nothing else. As it was done yesterday, the strong probability was that we should find the words in yesterday's issue."
"So far as I can follow you, then, Mr. Holmes," said Sir Henry Baskerville, "someone cut this message with the scissors."
"Nail scissors," said Holmes. "You can see that it was a very short-bladed scissor, since the cutter had to take two snips over, keep away."
"That is so. Someone, then, cut out the message with a pair of short-bladed scissors, pasted it with paste—"
"Gum," said Holmes.
"With gum onto the paper. But I want to know why the word moor should have been written."
"Because he could not find it in print. The other words were all simple and might be found in any issue, but moor would be less common."
"Why, of course, that would explain it. Have you read anything else in this message, Mr. Holmes?"
"There are one or two indications, and yet the utmost pains have been taken to remove all clues. The address, you observe, is printed in rough characters, but the Times, which is a paper which is seldom found in any hands but those of the highly educated. We may take it, therefore, that the letter was composed by an educated man who wished to pose as an uneducated one, and his effort to conceal his own writing suggests that that writing might be known, or come to be known, by you. Again, you will observe that the words are not gummed on in an accurate line, but that some are much higher than others. Life here, for example, is quite out of its proper place. That may point to carelessness, or it may point to agitation and hurry upon the part of the cutter. On the whole, I incline to the latter view, since the matter was evidently important, and it is unlikely that the composer of such a letter would be careless. If he were in a hurry, it opens up the interesting question why he should be in a hurry, since any letter posted up to early morning would reach Sir Henry before he would leave his hotel. Did the composer fear an interruption? And from whom?"
"We're coming now rather into the region of guesswork," said Dr. Mortimer.
"I say rather into the region where we balance probabilities and choose the most likely. It is the scientific use of the imagination, but we have always some material basis on which to start our speculation. Now, you would call it a guess, no doubt, but I'm almost certain that this address has been written in a hotel."
"How in the world can you say that?"
"If you examine it carefully, you will see that both the pen and the ink have given the writer trouble. The pen has spluttered twice in a single word, and has run dry three times in a short address, showing that there was very little ink in the bottle. Now, a private pen or ink bottle is seldom allowed to be in such a state, and the combination of the two must be quite rare. But you know the hotel ink and the hotel pen, where it is rare to get anything else. Yes, I have very little hesitation in saying that we could examine the waste paper baskets of the hotels around Charing Cross, until we found the remains of the mutilated Times leader, we could lay our hands straight upon the person who sent this singular message. Hello, what's this?
He was carefully examining the fool's cap upon which the words were pasted, holding it only an inch or two from his eyes. Well?
Nothing, said he, throwing it down. It is a blank half-sheet of paper, without even a watermark on it. I think we've drawn as much as we can from this curious letter. And now, Sir Henry, has anything else of interest happened to you since you've been in London?
Why, no, Mr. Holmes, I think not.
You have not observed anyone follow or watch you?
I seem to have walked right into the thick of a dime novel, said our visitor. Why in thunder should anyone follow or watch me?
We are coming to that. You have nothing else to report to us before we go into this matter?
Well, that depends on what you think is worth reporting.
I think anything out of the ordinary routine of life is well worth reporting.
Sir Henry smiled. I don't know much of the British life yet, for I've spent nearly all my time in the States and in Canada, but I hope that to lose one of your boots is not part of the ordinary routine of life over here.
You have lost one of your boots?
My dear sir,
cried Dr. Mortimer,
it is only mislaid. You will find it when you return to the hotel. What's the use of troubling Mr. Holmes with trifles of this kind?
Well, he asked me for anything outside the ordinary routine.
Exactly, said Holmes. However foolish the incident may seem. You have lost one of your boots, you say.
Well, mislaid it anyhow. I put them both outside my door last night, and there was only one in the morning. I could get no sense out of the chap who cleans them. The worst of it is that I only bought the pair last night in the Strand, and I've never had them on.
If you have never worn them, why did you put them out to be cleaned?
They were tan boots and had never been varnished. That was why I put them out.
Then I understand that on your arrival in London yesterday, you went out at once and bought a pair of boots.
Actually, I did a good deal of shopping. Dr. Mortimer here went round with me. You see, if I am to be squire down there, I must dress the part, and it may be that I've gotten a little careless in my ways out west. Among other things, I bought these brown boots, gave $6 for them, and had one stolen before I ever had them on my feet.
It seems a singularly useless thing to steal, said Sherlock Holmes. I confess that I share Dr. Mortimer's belief that it will not be long before the missing boot is found.
And now, gentlemen, said the baronet, with decision, it seems to me that I have spoken quite enough about the little that I know. It is time that you kept your promise and gave me a full account of what we're all driving at.
Your request is a very reasonable one, Holmes answered. Dr. Mortimer, I think you could not do better than to tell your story as you told it to us.
Thus encouraged, our scientific friend drew his papers from his pocket and presented the whole case as he had done upon the morning before. Sir Henry Baskerville listened with the deepest attention and with an occasional exclamation of surprise. Well, I seem to have come into an inheritance with a vengeance, said he, when the long narrative was finished. Of course, I've heard of the hound ever since I was in the nursery. It's the pet story of the family, although I never thought of taking it seriously before. But as to my uncle's death, well, it all seems boiling up in my head, and I can't get it clear yet. You don't seem quite to have made up your mind whether it's a case for a policeman or a clergyman.
Yes, precisely.
And now there's this affair of the letter to me at this hotel. I suppose that fits into its place.
It seems to show that someone knows more than we do about what goes on upon the moor,
said Dr. Mortimer.
And also, said Holmes, that someone is not ill-disposed towards you, since they warned you of danger.
Or it may be that they wish, for their own purposes, to scare me away.
Well, of course, that is possible also. I'm very much indebted to you, Dr. Mortimer, for introducing me to a problem which presents several interesting alternatives. But the practical point which we now have to decide, Sir Henry, is whether or not it is advisable for you to go to Baskerville Hall.
Why should I not go?
There seems to be danger.
Do you mean danger from this family fiend, or do you mean danger from human beings?
Well, that is what we have to find out.
Whichever it is, my answer is fixed. There's no devil in hell, Mr. Holmes, and there is no man upon earth who can prevent me from going to the home of my own people, and you may take that to be my final answer. His dark brows knitted, and his face flushed to a dusky red as he spoke. It was evident that the fiery temper of the Baskervilles was not extinct in this last representative. Meanwhile, said he, I have hardly had time to think over all that you have told me. It's a big thing for a man to have to understand and to decide at one sitting. I should like to have a quiet hour by myself to make up my mind. Now, look here, Mr. Holmes. It's 11:30 now, and I'm going back right away to my hotel. Suppose you and your friend, Dr. Watson, come round and lunch with us at 2. I'll be able to tell you much more clearly then how this thing strikes me.
Is that convenient to you, Watson?
Perfectly.
Then you may expect us. Shall I have a cab called?
I'd prefer to walk, for this affair has flurried me rather.
I'll join you in a walk, with pleasure,
said Dr. Mortimer.
Then we meet again at 2 o'clock. Au revoir, and good morning.
We heard the steps of our visitors descend the stair and the bang of the front door. In an instant, Holmes had changed from the languid dreamer to the man of action.
Your hat and boots, Watson, quick! Not a moment to lose!
He rushed into his room in his dressing gown and was back again in a few seconds in a frock coat. We hurried together down the stairs and into the street. Dr. Mortimer and Baskerville were still visible about 200 yards ahead of us in the direction of Oxford Street. Shall I run on and stop them?
Not for the world, my dear Watson. I am perfectly satisfied with your company, if you will tolerate mine. Our friends are wise, for it is certainly a very fine morning for a walk.
He quickened his pace until we had decreased the distance which divided us by about half. Then, still keeping 100 yards behind, we followed into Oxford Street and down toward Regent Street. Once our friend stopped and stared into a shop window, upon which Holmes did the same. An instant afterwards, he gave a little cry of satisfaction, and following the direction of his eager eyes, and I saw that a hansom cab with a man inside, which had halted on the other side of the street, was now proceeding slowly onward again.
"There's our man, Watson. Come along. We'll have a good look at him, if we can do no more."
At that instant, I was aware of a bushy black beard and a pair of piercing eyes turned upon us through the side window of the cab. Instantly, the trap door of the top flew up. Something was screamed to the driver, and the cab flew madly off down Regent Street. Holmes looked eagerly round for another, but no empty hansom was in sight. Then he dashed in wild pursuit amid the stream of the traffic, but the start they had was too great, and already the cab was out of sight.
"There now," said Holmes bitterly as he emerged panting and white with vexation from the tide of vehicles. "Was ever such bad luck and such bad management, too? Watson, if you're an honest man, you will record this also and set it against my successes."
"Who was the man?"
"I don't have a single idea."
"A spy?"
"Well, it was evident from what we've heard that Baskerville has been very closely shadowed by someone since he's been in town. How else could it be known so quickly that it was the Northumberland Hotel which he had chosen? If they had followed him the first day, I argued that they would follow him also the second. You may have observed that I twice strolled over to the window while Dr. Mortimer was reading his legend."
"Yes, I do remember that."
"I was looking out for loiterers in the street, but I saw none. We are dealing with a clever man, Watson. This matter cuts very deep, and though I have not finally made up my mind whether it is benevolent or a malevolent agency which is in touch with us, I am conscious always of power and design. When our friends left, I at once followed them in the hopes of marking down their invisible attendant. But so wily was he that he had not trusted himself upon foot, but he had availed himself of a cab so that he could loiter behind or dash past them, and so escape their notice. His method had the additional advantage that if they were to take a cab, he was all ready to follow them. It has, however, one obvious disadvantage.
It puts him in the power of the cabman.
Exactly.
What a pity we did not get the number.
My dear Watson, clumsy as I have been, you surely do not seriously imagine that I neglected to get the number. No, 2704 is our man, but that is no use to us for the moment.
I fail to see how you could have done more.
On observing the cab, I should have instantly turned and walked in the other direction. I should then, at my leisure, have hired a second cab and followed the first at a respectful distance, or better still, have driven to the Northumberland Hotel and waited there. When our unknown had followed Baskerville home, we should have had the opportunity of playing his own game upon himself and seeing what he was made of. As it is, by an indiscreet eagerness, which was taken advantage of with extraordinary quickness and energy by our opponent, we have betrayed ourselves and lost our man.
We had been sauntering slowly down Regent Street during this conversation, and Dr. Mortimer, with his companion, had long vanished in front of us.
"There is no object in our following them," said Holmes. "The shadow has departed and will not return. We must see what further cards we have in our hands and play them with decision. Could you swear to that man's face within the cab?"
"I could swear only to the beard."
"And so could I, from which I gathered that in all probability it was a false one. A clever man upon so delicate an errand has no use for a beard save to conceal his features. Come in here, Watson."
He turned into one of the district messenger offices, where he was warmly greeted by the manager.
"Ah, Wilson, I see you've not forgotten the little case in which I had good fortune to help you."
"No, sir, indeed, I have not. You saved my good name, and perhaps my life."
"My dear fellow, you exaggerate. I have some recollection, Wilson, that you had among you boys a lad named Cartwright, which showed some ability during the investigation."
"Yes, sir, and he's still with us."
"Could you ring him up?" "Thank you, and I should be glad to have change of this £5 note."
A lad of 14, with a bright, keen face, had obeyed the summons of the manager. He stood now gazing with great reverence at the famous detective.
"Let me have the hotel directory," said Holmes. "Thank you. Now, Cartwright, there are the names of 23 hotels here, all in the immediate neighborhood of Charing Cross. Do you see?"
"Yes, sir."
"You will visit each of these in turn."
"Yes, sir."
"You will begin in each case by giving the outside porter 1 shilling. Here are 23 shillings. You will tell him that you want to see the waste paper of yesterday. You will say that an important telegram has miscarried, and that you are looking for it. Do you understand?"
"Yes, sir, I do."
"But what you're really looking for is the center page of the Times, with some holes cut in it with scissors. Here is a copy of the Times. It is this page. You could easily recognize it, could you not?"
"Yes, sir."
"In each case, the outside porter will send for the hall porter, to whom also you will give 1 shilling. Here are 23 shillings. You will then learn in possibly 20 cases out of the 23 that the waste of the day before has been burned or removed. In the 3 other cases, you will be shown a heap of paper, and you will look for this page of the Times among it. The odds are enormously against your finding it. There are 10 shillings over in case of emergencies. Let me have a report by wire at Baker Street before evening. And now, Watson, it only remains for us to find out by wire the identity of the cabman. Number 2704, and then we will drop into one of the Bond Street picture galleries and fill in the time until we're due at the hotel."
Coming next week, Chapters 5 and 6 of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's The Hound of the Baskervilles, A Sherlock Holmes Adventure. It's a good time to thank all of you. Reviews are our life's blood. Those, and sharing our podcast with others, letting them know what we are, why you enjoy them, and how to find them. That's how we grow. And here are some recent reviews. Our first one, 5 stars. Hero. Great storyteller and clearly a lover of learning. Thank you. Down from Ray Junkion, Apple Podcast, Great Britain. And this one, great again. 5 stars. Really love your voice and storytelling of the classics. Reminds me of my grandmother reading her and Grandpa's childhood books to me. All first and second editions of Tarzan, Mark Twain's, and of others from the 1890s and 1900. Most of them hand-me-downs from older brothers and sisters. Remember Grandma skipping over parts of Tarzan? She said they were too racy for young Christian ears. Never could figure out what parts those were. Ha ha. Wish I had those books now. My cousin got them when Grandma passed away. Thank you for the memories you brought back to me of the good old days of childhood. That one from Wolfie Wolf, Apple Podcast, U.S. And this one, 5 stars, wonderful way to pass time. John, since I first heard your work on 1001 Histories, I found it to be entertaining, interesting, and spooky at times. I'm thinking of Skinwalker Ranch. There is something about your voice and style that is comforting. I guess it's the equivalent of a comfortable leather chair with an excellent light for reading. The sort of thing one looks forward to. I'm very glad to have found your short stories podcast exhibiting those same strengths. I loved H.H. Munro as a young reader, so I'm happy to listen to many of his stories which are new to me. I'll send another tip-top review in the near future and try not to be so wordy. That one from Dave Jefferson, the great state of Maine, Apple Podcast. And here's one, 5 stars, suggestion for a reading. Love your stuff. Thought I'd make a suggestion for a story. Zane Grey, noted for westerns, wrote on other subjects. The one I enjoyed the most were on baseball. In his book, The Shortstop, in the chapter titled Sunday Baseball, it gives an inspirational account and narration of why, as Americans, we love the game of baseball. Excellent topic for your show. P.S. I discovered that not only was he a prolific writer, he had played baseball in college, wrote children's books, and books about fishing, evidently an avid outdoorsman taking trips that lasted months. But he was a dentist. No wonder I liked him. That one from Gerald G. Gell, DDS, a great friend of this show. Gerald, thank you, and by the way, there's another baseball story out there this week at 1001 Classic Short Stories and Tales. And we've also expanded our short stories categories. We just added a new classic short story show called 1001 Greatest Love Stories. And that one's available at Apple, Stitcher, and a lot of other places, as it's just starting to get well-known and spread around. So we encourage you, those of you who'd like 1001 Classic Short Stories and Tales here, also find and subscribe to 1001 Greatest Love Stories. And I think you'll find it's for everybody. I stick to the subject of men and women, hearth and home, and that type of thing. I'd like you all to give it a listen and enjoy. And for those of you who don't subscribe, who would like to get all of our episodes in one place, have you ever tried our website? That's 1001storiespodcast.com. Every show we do is listed there, so you can get them all in one place. The sound quality is excellent. Thanks for joining us today. It's great having you with us. Everybody stay safe, and we'll be back next week with more Sherlock Holmes.